at Curto's, or Stephen over Matilda. Coronation and anointing were a bit magic. It meant you were a king by divine right. In a telling incident after the ceremony, which happened in June 1170, in case you're keeping track of time, Henry II had served his son food at the celebratory feast in order to mark the young lad's elevation. This was obviously a bit of symbolic ceremonial that someone thought would be nice. The Archbishop of York, wanting to be a good guest and feeling lucky to have got what was usually Canterbury's gig, piped up politely, saying what a distinguished servant young Henry had. I imagine there were chuckles. Then the young king replied that it was entirely proper that his father should serve him, as he, the son, was of higher rank, being the child of royalty on both sides, rather than the son of a queen and a duke. Silence. A cough. This was quite a cunty remark for a 15-year-old to make. It sounds to me like an appeal to porphyrogeniture, but it's tactless to say the least. He was lucky his dad wasn't in a clothes-tearing mood. It was a sign both of the boy's unhelpfully high self-esteem and of his low astuteness. And another example of his father's poor judgment of character. Gradually it became clear that the young king wasn't going to be allowed any real power. Then, in 1173, the old king gave three castles to his youngest son and the young king's younger brother, John, as part of some marriage negotiations he was engaged in on the boy's behalf. And for some reason, this was the last straw. Henry Jr. ran off to the court of his father-in-law and his mother's ex-husband, Louis VII. There he started a rebellion with which the King of France was delighted to help out. Also joining the rebellion were two more of Henry II's sons, Richard, Duke of Aquitaine, and Geoffrey, Duke of Brittany. These teenagers were incensed that their father hadn't yet given them any real power either, and they were egged on, if not put up to it in the first place, by their mother, Eleanor of Aquitaine. All in all, they're a ripe bunch of inheritors of the Plantagenet temper. The only son who didn't rebel was John, who was six. He rebelled later, though, despite being his father's favourite, another example of terrible judgment of character by the king, as we'll see. But if his judgment of character was poor, the course of the rebellion was a resounding endorsement of Henry II's other kingly skills. He looked like he was screwed, but he totally vanquished them. A masterstroke within this conflict came in the summer of 1174, when he declared the rebellion a punishment from God for what had happened to Becket and went to Canterbury to perform elaborate penance. He walked barefoot through the city, was thrashed by the monks of the cathedral, and spent the night fasting and praying. As efforts to avoid cancellation go, it was extremely dramatic. Regardless of the sincerity or otherwise with which Henry entered into it, this was a powerful piece of political theatre. He established a narrative turning point, a reason for people to believe the momentum was going his way. And the belief that this was true made it true. He understood that people wanted his stable kingship, and they wanted to be given a reason to think it was going to be restored. It was vital to tipping the balance in his favour. Soon all his sons were humbly seeking forgiveness, which the king had the good sense to grant. His marriage never recovered, though, as he found Eleanor's role harder to forgive, and so he imprisoned her for the rest of his reign, only occasionally letting her out for ceremonial purposes. A fictionalised version of one of these away weekends is dramatised in the film The Lion in Winter, in which Eleanor is played by Katharine Hepburn and her husband by Peter O'Toole. It's an interesting film. It's set at Christmas, and they have a Christmas tree in the castle, but with no fairy lights. I can't understand this, as it wouldn't have significantly worsened the anachronism, but it would have looked nice and twinkly. The main problem with the film, for me, is that it inextricably links my imagining of Henry II to O'Toole and of Eleanor of Aquitaine to Catherine Hepburn. Hepburn seems so wise and warm and noble, and O'Toole so headstrong and chaotic, that you end up thinking Henry was a lucky but barbaric idiot, and Eleanor a wronged goddess, which I don't think is fair. Henry had many mistresses, which must have upset Eleanor, but her relentless egging of her sons on to rebellion is quite annoying. Henry may have triumphed in 1174, but he was fighting his sons, in various groupings, on and off for the rest of his life. It exhausted him in the end. His energy, his ability to appear at opposite ends of his realm only a few days apart, had always been his trump card. In 1189, illness and his current conflict against Richard and a new improved King of France were not going his way. He died, alone and betrayed, in Chinon Castle in Touraine. Then again, if he'd wanted his wife to be with him, he shouldn't have put her in prison. The obvious question about all this is, why couldn't they just wait? These sons were going to be fine, weren't they? It's your dad's kingdom, but you'll get it when he dies. Isn't that reasonable? The answer, I suppose, is that they were cash rich but time poor. It was the Middle Ages, and they could die at any moment. Eleanor, her marriage over in all but name, wanted to see her sons fulfil their potential. As it turned out, she outlived her husband by 15 years, but she probably didn't expect to because she was 11 years older than him. Henry II's grip wasn't just on the Kingdom of England and vast territories in France, it was on time itself. His sons must have thought him a glutton for life, living theirs as well as his own. It turns out their feelings were justified. Both Geoffrey, Duke of Brittany, and Henry the Young King predeceased their father. The young king's irksome instinct to rule from the moment he was crowned is recontextualised by the fact that he didn't have long. Chapter 19. King Richard I. Nowadays, we seem to have a strange and spiky relationship with King Richard I, and I reckon it's all about lions. Richard was the first king to bear a shield with three lions on it, the three lions we now associate with England. And associate is an understatement. They're like a hieroglyph meaning England. I'm talking about those golden ones that are still on the royal coat of arms, as well as the England football shirt, though those ones aren't gold, and are sort of lying down while mugging to camera. Or passant gardant, to put that unnatural pose in the jargon of heraldry. Heraldry, all the shields and badges and coats of arms, was just getting going in the late 12th century, so it's understandable that that's the time from which the basic badge of our monarchy dates. The problem for Richard's legacy is that the badge is deeply, inextricably linked to the notion of England. Those lions are English lions, we think, without pausing to ask why we should associate our country with a non-native animal. If we do, we just assume that England adopted lions in the same way that Wales did dragons. From an English perspective, lions might as well be fictional. You don't need to have seen a real one to appreciate the power of the symbol, and it's a thoroughly English symbol, it seems to us. That, in turn, made it a thoroughly British symbol, and then a British imperial symbol. It was convenient in this regard that the Scottish crown had independently adopted a lion rampant, standing on its hind legs, as its main badge. There are enormous lions in Trafalgar Square, and a lion as one of the supporters of the royal coat of arms, as well as those original lounging lions on the shield. The lion symbol went everywhere the British Empire conquered, an emblem of European control of many areas where, ironically, real lions actually live. Also, you have the lion as a symbol of England or Britain in political cartoons, scaring Napoleon or having its tail glued on by Gladstone. And there's British lion films and British lion eggs and the British Lions rugby team and the lions that were led by donkeys in the First World War, and it's got to the point where the lion and the Union Jack have somehow merged in our heads and have been physically merged in things like Olympic team logos. They've become pictorial synonyms. So that's the hinterland when we come to contemplate King Richard the Lionheart of England, whose symbol was those three lions. It sounds like he's putting himself across as pretty fucking English. He's basically calling himself England McEnglishface. Then, when we find out that, along with England's entire ruling class at the time, he didn't even speak English, and he spent only 6 months of his reign in England, almost all of it feverishly extorting as much cash as he could to spend on foreign military exploits, we feel a bit let down. We feel like he's been passing himself off as something he's not. So much for being English, he doesn't give a shit about the place. This is quite unfair on Richard the Lionheart. He never claimed to give a shit about England. On the contrary, he apparently said, on the subject of his ruthless fundraising drive, "I would have sold London if I could find a buyer." If only he'd known some Russians. Some say that the three lions on Richard's shield represent not merely England, but Normandy, Aquitaine and England, Richard's main three dominions. This makes sense. Why have three of them otherwise? It's a bit random. A lion is a cool badge, but three lions isn't any cooler. It may be that two-thirds of the symbol of the England football team actually represent regions of France. We need to get away from the notion that Richard was, in any way, trying or claiming to be English. He was the scion of a major French noble house who were such big shots they had their own rainy North European kingdom as a sort of country retreat. They went there for a break from continental politics and as a convenient place to have hunting accidents. For Richard, it was a splendid source of funds to pay for his main priority, raising a big army to take part in the Third Crusade. This was the fashionable and righteous thing to be doing at the time, like going vegan is now, but with the opposite impact on the amount of blood that gets shed. Richard was determined to travel to the Holy Land, as the Middle East was enticingly known before everyone gave up any attempt to make it sound nice, with enough of a force to maintain and extend the Christian kingdom there and reconquer Jerusalem. To my mind, Lionheart is an entirely appropriate nickname for him, once we dissociate the lion from its fictional and heraldic manifestation. Lions are not really noble beasts. They are not proud, they do not have principles, and they don't stand up for weaker people and defend island races. They don't like England, they find it too cold and rainy. The lion is a ruthless predator who deploys awesome violence in its own interests. As with the finger that shares its colour, its heart is cold. Some sort of personal crusade. Richard's key attribute was being extraordinarily good at fighting. And by fighting, I mean large-scale fighting, making war. He was physically brave, a resourceful general, a cunning tactician, and he was conscientious about logistics. This was why he bled England dry of money and resources. He realised that if he was to go on crusade, he would need a hell of a lot of stuff. Courage and praying weren't going to cut it on their own. The Crusades were a series of chaotic and vicious attempts by Western European Christians to wrest control of what is now Israel, Palestine and bits of Lebanon and Syria from Muslims, the infidel, as Christians called them, and as they called Christians. Crusades were all the rage between the late 11th and late 13th centuries, and rage is the operative word. Various popes initiated them, incensed as they then were, in both senses of the word, by the existence and geographical spread of Islam. It developed into a great scheme for posh, murderous people who were struggling to find meaning in their lives to secure their places in heaven. Robert Curthose went on one, you may recall. They're grim, a manifestation of what today we'd call religious extremism that resulted in thousands of horrific deaths in battle and from disease. Personally, I can't imagine any of the Christians who went on crusade not perpetually having the shits while wearing full armour in the baking sun. It's a bit gross. The combination of Western Europe's ignorance of the principles of food hygiene with maintaining an army in an alien climate must have made it an absolute field day for dysentery bacteria, though I suppose the Crusaders had stronger stomachs than we do, having reached adulthood in a culture with no reliable system for separating sewage from drinking water. It sounds disgusting and lethal even if you don't factor in all the battles you might get killed in if you were lucky enough to win your game of food poisoning roulette. Every single thing they did, it seems to me, must have attracted an enormous number of flies. If there's anything picturesque about the Middle Ages, and there is, stone crenellations silhouetted against winter skies, galloping horsemen with steaming breath, vast cathedrals echoing to muttered devotions, it vanishes at the contemplation of excrement and extreme heat. Conquering and then permanently occupying a large area of the Middle East, which may have been sacred to Christianity but was also sacred to the religion of all the people who lived round there, is a famously difficult and uncomfortable thing to do. It's even uncomfortable reading a paragraph about it here and now in London because some sharp-eared listeners will be analysing it for inappropriate views on the Israel-Palestine situation. If this were a website instead of an audiobook, I'd have installed cookies so that this section could manifest exactly the same views on that situation as the listener has previously betrayed with their browsing history. But I can't, so let me just say that I am passionately committed to whatever it is you think. If it's all a bit tricky now, it was worse then. The Crusaders were travelling vast distances without any maps worth the name and trying to keep armies fed and watered as they went. Plus, the people whom the survivors of the journey had come to fight not only had colossal home advantage, they also hadn't endured the economic and technological knockback of the Dark Ages in the way Western Europe had. The Franks, as Western Europeans were often collectively known, were a backward civilization compared to the Islamic states from which they tried to conquer the Holy Land. The fact that the Crusaders kind of managed, off and on, to maintain a collection of Christian states near, and occasionally including, Jerusalem, is a real testament to how nuts they all were. It's a major example from history of the energizing power of insanity, like when a tiny maddened terrier nearly succeeds in killing a postman. Thousands and thousands of Christians became convinced that waging this distant, impossible, and savage war was the right thing to do, that it was vital, that it would bring them salvation. Suddenly, all the shitting and killing were worth it. Richard may not have cared about England, but he cared passionately about his crusader vow. He was sincerely devout. But then why wouldn't he be? The church authorities had announced that there was a way he could do his favourite thing, attacking lots of people with an army, in a really holy way. It was as if the Pope had told George Best that what Jesus really wanted him to do, what would make him an absolute saint and hero, was to get pissed. Richard's crusade, known as the Third Crusade, failed in its aim of reconquering Jerusalem, but otherwise went pretty well, and reconquered the cities of Acre and Jaffa on behalf of Outremer, which is the weird name given to the collection of tottering Frankish states in the Middle East. Richard, who arrived in June 1191, having suavely conquered Cyprus and used it as a wedding venue on his way, was the star of the whole enterprise. The other major participating monarchs were the Holy Roman Emperor, Frederick Barbarossa, most famous for having Hitler's cataclysmic attempt to destroy the Soviet Union named after him, and Philip II of France, subsequently known as Philip Augustus, but he would never have got that cool nickname on the strength of his crusading form. Richard totally overshadowed him, so he left early in a fit of pique. Emperor Frederick, meanwhile, drowned before he got there. Richard enjoyed all the military success, developing a mutual, grudging respect for the Muslim Sultan, Saladin, with whom he corresponded. He headed home in 1192 only because he got wind that Philip II and his brother John were conspiring to steal England. The Crusades were pointless in the end, of course. Outremer was finally snuffed out in 1291, and Constantinople itself, the new Rome and centre of the Byzantine Empire, fell to the Turks in 1453. The attempt to reverse the tide of the world's newest global religion by the world's second newest global religion was a colossal waste of energy. That tide kept rising for nearly 500 years and lapped against the gates of Vienna before it turned. Kidnapped, betrayed, shot, cuddled. Speaking of Vienna, it was near there in the run-up to Christmas 1192 that Richard was captured. He was then held to ransom. He was vulnerable to this because he'd had a terrible journey. Bad weather had forced his ship to put into Corfu, which was part of the Byzantine Empire where he was persona non grata for the understandable reason that he'd recently nicked Cyprus off it. He left swiftly and in disguise with only four attendants, which would be lots for you and me, but is a pitiful number for kings and rap stars. He then got properly shipwrecked right at the north end of the Adriatic Sea, and was forced to continue his journey overland, much of which was run by other people he'd managed to piss off by being so haughty and successful. Leopold V, Duke of Austria, was one such person. He'd been on the Third Crusade too, but the two of them were unlikely to be seated together at any reunion dinners. Richard had infuriated him on the occasion of Acre falling to the Crusaders by removing Leopold's banners from the city walls on the basis that Leopold wasn't important enough. This was petty of Richard, but no pettier than Leopold, who stormed off back to Austria to concentrate on bearing a grudge. The following Christmas, Richard turned up like a lovely present, unguarded and wearing an unconvincing disguise instead of wrapping paper. Leopold captured him and, in March 1193, handed him over to the Holy Roman Emperor, Henry VI. This period of incarceration doesn't fit with the rest of Richard's career because he didn't do anything cool or valiant to get out of it. He was passive and trapped, reduced to working on his music like a teenager in his bedroom. The emperor charged an enormous ransom of £100,000 of silver, and Richard's mum, Eleanor of Aquitaine, had to go about organising for it to be paid. The phrase £100,000 of silver, or 150,000 marks, which is apparently the same thing, doesn't really convey any meaning to me other than big. It was a lot of money, and not just for a king or nobleman, but for a large European state. I'm afraid I glaze over at historians' attempts to explain money in the distant past and say what pounds, shillings and pence were worth in modern terms, or explain the difference between a pound and a mark, and an English pound and an Angevin pound, and an imperial mark and an English mark. So let me summarise. It's extremely confusing. Money is so different now that it's frankly unhelpful that the same word applies both to what Eleanor of Aquitaine sent to the Holy Roman Emperor and to what I would use to buy a Twix. It's not just the quantity that's different. The use of and access to currency has totally changed. Plus a Twix, unremarkable chocolate bar though it seems to us, would be more magical and delicious than anything anyone in the 12th century, even the Byzantine or Chinese emperors, had ever laid eyes or decayed teeth on. So we might as well dispense with the numbers and express sums of money in terms of the pain that extracting it caused. And this would have been an arg of the size that Thor would emit if he stood on a plug. And he wouldn't know what a plug was, so you can mix some bewilderment in with the pain. It was another huge drain on the reserves of Richard's dominions, but without the supposed celestial upside of bankrolling Islamophobic mass murder. Richard didn't get back to his realm until February 1194. When he was released, Philip, not yet called Augustus of France, reportedly said to his co-conspirator, Richard's brother John, "Look to yourself, the devil is loose." They both hated Richard, and Philip must have been bitterly aware that, with Richard around, the whole Augustus thing just wasn't going to happen. I mean, not that specific sobriquet, but the success from which it might spring. On crusade or off, Richard always bested Philip II of France. As well as introducing the Lions of England, Richard was the first monarch to adopt the royal motto Dieu et mon droit, God and my right, which I mentioned earlier and which is used to this day, written proudly in thousands of public places and on the front of everyone's passport. His reign is structured like the motto. The first half he spent fighting for God and the second for his right, i.e. all the dominions he'd inherited from his father, many of which Philip was attempting to purloin. It took Richard most of the rest of his reign to secure his right back from Philip, but he never looked like he wouldn't manage it. He forgave his brother John, whose meanness, greed, cowardice and treachery are the only part of the Robin Hood story that's factually accurate. Richard couldn't really take him seriously, and John tended to behave while Richard was around. Richard eventually named John as his heir, which wasn't entirely uncontroversial because by primogeniture the throne should have gone to Arthur, the son of John's elder and Richard's younger brother Geoffrey, the late Duke of Brittany. But Arthur was a child and John was a fully matured, horrible adult, so it was obvious to Richard who ought to be king. By the spring of 1199, Richard's position was secure and he was relaxing by laying siege to a small castle, Chalus-Chabrol, in the Limousin region of Aquitaine, where there was a small rebellion going on. The castle had a tiny garrison and Richard was inspecting the castle walls, not wearing his chainmail because he was super cool, when he noticed a valiant sentry high on the battlements defending himself from the besiegers' arrows with a frying pan. Richard paused to applaud this bravery in a foe for just long enough for the pan-wielder to pick up a crossbow and shoot him in the shoulder. Undaunted by this flesh wound, Richard calmly rode off to get some terrible medical attention before dying of the consequent raging infection in less than a fortnight. He'd always been Eleanor of Aquitaine's favourite son, and she made it to his deathbed in time for him to die in her arms, which was nice. Chapter 20. King John. King John was not a good man. He had his little ways, and sometimes no one spoke to him for days and days and days. And men who came across him when walking in the town gave him a supercilious stare or passed with noses in the air, and bad King John stood dumbly there, blushing beneath his crown. I couldn't resist starting the chapter with that. It's from King John's Christmas, a poem by A.A. Milne. It uses the key thing we all know about King John, that he was bad, and reimagines him amid the values and references of early 20th century children's literature. It continues, "King John was not a good man, and no good friends had he. He stayed in every afternoon, but no one came to tea." It's a world where there is nothing to fear from bad people. They get their comeuppance when no one wants to go to tea with them, and Father Christmas won't give them any presents. Though that reminds me of the occasion in 1937, only a few years after the poem was published, when a couple of the Mitford sisters went for tea with Hitler. It seems that Milne's system of social sanctions, the withholding of company over scones, as a means of ameliorating the conduct of international leaders, wasn't always observed, even by the most pucker members of society. Still, it's a comforting thought, and you can imagine King John walking carefully along the pavement, avoiding the cracks, while passing schoolchildren regard him sternly, and then Mr. Toad zooms past in his new car and soaks King John with puddle water, and Peter Pan pokes him in the bottom with a sword. It taps into the haplessness that King John projects down the centuries, as if his badness was an affliction from which the poor fellow couldn't escape. Well, he was bad, and he was hapless. Delightfully, his reputation is deserved, and the debunkers of all the fun and clear notions about the past, the revisionists, the revisers of the revisionists, have failed to put even a scratch on the gleaming paintwork of King John's famous shittiness. Efforts have been made, but the best the narrative clarity police have managed is to point out that John was unlucky in some respects, and at times displayed various forms of competence. What no one has sought to deny, though, is that he was a horrible person and his reign was spectacularly unsuccessful. So poor was the management he provided that it famously spurred the English aristocracy into unionising. That's what led to Magna Carta. Magna Carta just meant Great Charter, though now it means so much more. Some would call it the foundation stone of English liberty. If that's true, the architect of English liberty should be struck off by whatever organisation regulates the metaphorical professions, because it's a bloody wobbly foundation. But English liberty has no architect. It just got thrown together by various accidents, one of which was John's personality. Temporarily agreed to by John in 1215, Magna Carta was a relatively ambitious attempt to rein in the monarch's power and tentatively introduced the idea that kings don't just make the rules, they should also abide by them. Or make some effort to abide by them. Or at least acknowledge that that would be nice. There should be some sort of thing, the law, the constitution, the customs of the realm, that existed separately from the person of the king and the surprisingly malleable tenets of Christianity. This was quite a big and tiring idea, but the barons were forced to come up with it by John's relentless, deceitful cruelty and incompetence. John agreed to Magna Carta only because he was in such deep trouble that he'd lose his crown if he didn't. He repudiated it a few weeks later. In his view, the kingdom was his personal property, so the idea that it could generate rules that he would then have to obey was as absurd to him as if a billionaire found a no diving, no bombing sign by the side of his private swimming pool. "I'll do what I fucking like," he thought. In fact, "I'll do what I fucking like" was, broadly speaking, John's policy. If translated into Latin or Norman French, it would have made an arresting and appropriate motto for the royal family. That said, some of John's more competent predecessors, his own father among them, would have explained to him that whatever the legal situation pre-Magna Carta, there were enormous practical limits on kingship. Behind all the "I'm the Lord's anointed" projection of entitlement and ownership, the clever and successful monarchs knew the score. The nature of their power fluctuated hugely and depended on other people going along with their rule. John, on the other hand, seems to have been an instinctive believer in the hype of early medieval kingship. That misplaced confidence is what nearly brought the whole unjust edifice crashing down. His failure to question it in his own mind led to the barons starting to question it in theirs. They were reluctant to do so because kingship was a reassuring idea and felt natural, but John forced them to think. King John was not a successful man. Magna Carta happened near the end of John's reign and life, and he'd got a huge amount of failure under his belt first. John was Henry II's youngest son and was the old king's favourite. This has the same quality of embarrassing comic weirdness as when, in A Midsummer Night's Dream, Titania falls in love with Bottom when he's got a donkey's head. No one else seemed to like John, and the fact that he was Henry's son doesn't really explain his father's enthusiasm, because Henry wasn't particularly keen on any of his other sons, and they were all nicer than John. That sentence may win the world record for the smallest compliment ever paid. Despite his father's favouritism, an aura of misfortune surrounded John. Having made his son Henry a nominal co-sovereign and earmarked Aquitaine for Richard and Brittany for Geoffrey, Henry II had nothing much left for the apple of his eye, and consequently John was given the nickname Lackland. This was as humiliating as calling him loser, and in retrospect, loser would have been more apt. Specifically, land loser. At the age of 10, he was made Lord of Ireland. If you think that sounds more problematic and less fun than being made Duke of a nice sunny part of France, then you're right. Angevin control of Ireland was shaky, and Ireland was a long, cold sea voyage in the opposite direction from the centres of power. Even when you got there, it was very rebellious and rainy rather than relaxing and calm. I expect there were nice walks and a strong local artistic tradition, but the Angevins were more into clubbing, in every sense. English control of Ireland has never really worked out, as you'll know if you've watched the news at any point since the invention of television. And with John's lordship, it got off to a bad start. In 1185, he went over there as a teenager to try and extend his power, but succeeded only in offending the local rulers by taking the piss out of their unfashionably long beards. While Richard had been away on crusade or in captivity, John relentlessly and unsuccessfully attempted to nick all his brother's lands by colluding with the King of France and claiming that Richard was dead. He was warming to his theme of being neither nice nor successful. As soon as Richard actually was dead, King Philip seized the opportunity to earn that Augustus sobriquet fate had earmarked for him. Now that John was his useless competitor rather than his useless ally, he turned on him. He started by recognising John's rival claimant to the throne, Arthur, the son of Geoffrey, as Richard's heir. As previously noted, by strict primogeniture, Arthur would have been the next king, but the fact that John was accepted as the rightful successor in most of Richard's domains, including England and Normandy, is a sign that the rules of succession were still fluid. The previous king's wishes are a real clincher. This is interesting because it shows that the notion that these kingdoms and dukedoms were merely a powerful man's personal property was very strong. This is the very interpretation of kingship that the barons who drafted Magna Carta were trying to get away from. John's accession is also a sign that, as an adult man, he was deemed a safer pair of hands than Arthur, who was still a child. The potential hazardousness of Arthur's pair of hands was, conversely, his claim's key selling point for Philip. He wanted Angevin power to founder. That's why he'd backed John during Richard's reign. As it turned out, backing John would have remained a sound policy for screwing the Angevin Empire, because John's pair of hands, despite their comparative maturity, turned out to be deeply unsafe, as Arthur found out when John used them to murder him. Possibly. We can't know. Arthur died in 1203 while being held captive by John. Capturing Arthur was one of John's few successes. Arthur probably died by John's order, and there's a real chance it was an order he gave to his own hands. Even measured against the low level of niceness expected of rulers at this time, murdering your own teenage nephew was still dastardly. Keeping him in prison for the rest of his life was regarded as the done thing. By the end of 1204, after a couple of years of fighting against Philip, John had lost all Angevin possessions in France, apart from the southern section of Aquitaine, and had retreated to England, where he focused on alienating the ruling class. We don't want the same thing anymore. John was understandably obsessed with finding a way to reconquer Normandy. Duke of Normandy was, in a sense, what he primarily was. He was William the Conqueror's great-great-grandson. He must have felt that getting Normandy back was his destiny and relatively achievable. The English throne had been separated from Normandy several times since the conquest, during the reigns of William II, Henry I, and Stephen, and the Norman realm had always been subsequently reunited. But this was different. During the previous separation periods, the dukedom had been ruled by another member of the family, albeit a rival, Robert Curthose, Geoffrey of Anjou, or the future Henry II. This time, it was held by the actual King of France, and, to cut a long story short, that situation didn't change, except for a brief period in the early 15th century, until 1792, when the King of France was put in prison during the Revolution as a precursor to being decapitated. This is an important moment. It put the Anglo-Norman aristocracy in an awkward position. Over the many decades since 1066, some families had split their lands so that the English ones were held by one branch and the Norman ones by another. The sense of a joint aristocracy was less strong. Still, lots of powerful people hadn't been so prudent. They had estates in both places and didn't know what to do. There was one obvious idea circulating. In May 1204, before John's position in France had quite collapsed, William Marshall, a top Plantagenet retainer, of whom we'll hear more later, and the Earl of Leicester, one of history's many Earls of Leicester, of whom we won't, was sent to Philip to negotiate a truce. While doing so, they took the opportunity to inquire of the French king about what the deal might be going forward with their Norman lands. Philip said they could keep them if they paid a fine of 500 marks each, which in modern money is lots, and swore homage to him for those lands by Easter 1205. This Easter deadline offer was open to all Anglo-Norman barons with Norman lands and was tempting. From Philip's point of view, it was a good idea, because those who swore homage to him couldn't really then join a military campaign by John to reconquer Normandy. The opportunity played on the barons' minds, and just before Easter 1205, a group of them tentatively asked John if it would be okay with him if they did this. I can barely imagine a more awkward scene. The barons sidling up to this bad-tempered king who'd just fucked up his ancestral inheritance and asking if, in the light of His Majesty's monumental recent cock-up, they might swear allegiance to his nemesis so that they could keep all their stuff even though he had lost so much of his stuff. They said they would swear allegiance with their bodies, but their hearts would still be with John. Nice try. John obviously was not okay with this for the very reasons that Philip was in favour of it. It would hugely weaken his chances of reconquering Normandy. The truth is, though, that they were weakened anyway. Some barons stayed in Normandy, swore allegiance to Philip, and forfeited their English lands. More common among John's barons was to stay in England and forfeit their Norman lands. The most loyal of these were compensated with lands forfeited by the lords who'd stayed in Normandy and sided with Philip. This had the effect of reducing the number of barons with cross-channel possessions. So even though they weren't prevented from fighting against Philip in Normandy by having given homage, they didn't have much to gain from it anymore. They'd cut their losses. Now their possessions, and therefore their priorities, were Anglo-centric. This was an increasing obstacle to the ambitions of John and his successors to reconquer the Angevin Empire. They had become solely royal ambitions, no longer shared by the aristocracy. In time, they seemed less and less realistic and, to the English ruling class, more and more enervating. This shift in the status quo manifested itself early. In the summer of 1205, less than a year after fleeing Normandy, John energetically set about assembling an invasion force to win everything back. He requisitioned an enormous fleet, raised men, minted coins, and got all the invasion stuff together, food, arrows, etc. It was to be an ambitious pincer movement. John would lead an invasion of Normandy from Portsmouth, while his illegitimate half-brother, William Longspay, Earl of Salisbury, would simultaneously take a force from Dartmouth down the west coast to La Rochelle and invade Poitou from there. John got everything ready in Portsmouth, and the barons arrived, and John said, OK, let's go, and they wouldn't. They didn't fancy it. William Marshall and Hubert Walter, the Archbishop of Canterbury, did the talking for the barons, citing various reasons why the invasion was unwise. Philip's wealth and military strength, the notoriously treacherous nature of the Poitvin, the fact that Philip might invade England if it was left undefended. What it amounted to was, "Look, Your Majesty, we don't have enough to gain from this plan, considering the likelihood that you will fuck it up." John was furious and humiliated. He even put to sea and sailed up and down the coast for a few days in the hope that they'd follow him. It was a sort of maritime version of storming out. Everyone must have found this pretty embarrassing. No one got in a boat to go and check that he was okay. Apart from his obsession with continental reconquest, the other source of tension between John and the English barons after 1204 is that he was always there. Have you heard of the phenomenon of long and apparently happy marriages foundering after the couple retires because for the first time both husband and wife are spending all day together? The English aristocracy were like an old school housewife, accustomed to packing off their old man to work/France and not expecting him back for ages. Every king since William the Conqueror had been more often out than in. Suddenly, John was there the whole time, getting under their feet. Plus, he hadn't retired, he'd been made redundant, and he was determined to get his job back. Now the simile collapses, because the way he needed to get his job back was by lots of expensive fighting, for which the wife-slash-aristocracy would have to pay in blood and treasure. It was a fun few sentences while it lasted. John's best friend, the Pope. John did manage a couple of decent goes at reconquering his old bits of France, but they didn't work. He had a relatively successful campaign in 1206 and stabilised his position in the last bit of France he still possessed, inconveniently placed in the bottom left-hand corner, down by the Pyrenees. But he never got close to restoring his enormous losses of 1204, and his final campaign to do so was decisively ended at the Battle of Bouvines in Flanders in 1214, at which John's allies, led by Otto the Holy Roman Emperor, were defeated by Philip. Fair enough, he does now seem quite Augustus. John wasn't even there. He was hanging around La Rochelle with another pincer movement in mind. But Philip had snapped off the top pincer, so John was reduced to being a lone bottom pincer. Just a prick, basically. All this fruitless campaigning had necessitated a great deal of brutal and unscrupulous money-raising in England. So when John got back there in October, he wasn't met by a lovely supportive aristocracy telling him he mustn't feel bad about himself. They were livid and broke. So was he. The barons demanded that John be less of a dick and abide by Henry I's coronation charter and his own coronation oath. There were unsuccessful talks, and both sides wrote to Pope Innocent III. Relations between John and the papacy had been volatile, as you might expect. But volatile beats consistently shit, so in the end, John's dealings with the Pope amounted to one of his most successful professional relationships. There were problems, of course. The king's whole "I'll do what I fucking like" vibe was fundamentally antithetical to papal thinking, or to any religion, really. In 1209, he'd been excommunicated for relentlessly encroaching on the church's prerogatives and taking its money, and by 1213, the Pope had declared him deposed, which meant that any other ruler, say Philip Augustus, had a perfect right to come and nab his kingdom. In light of this, John changed tack and swore feudal vassalage to the Pope. This dramatic U-turn shows even greater cynicism about religion than invoking and then ignoring excommunication. To my mind, John seems unusually irreligious for his time, something I find no easier to warm to than his other traits. It genuinely seems possible that he was an atheist. In our current age, atheism is a coherent and reasonable response to the human condition. To be an atheist in 13th century Europe was very different. At this time, Christianity was the self-evident truth. It wasn't a conclusion many people came to, it was the starting point of everything. It was also the rationale and justification of kingship. To be anointed a king at this time, while secretly thinking it's all horseshit, is sociopathic. Still, Pope Innocent was thrilled with John's change of policy and insufficiently self-doubting to question its sincerity. The pontiff remained staunchly in John's camp until his death, only 3 months before John's, and repeatedly told the barons to stop rebelling and pay whatever taxes John fancied levying. In March 1215, John put a delicious hypocritical cherry on the top of his big cake of Pope-courting bullshit by taking the cross. This was supposedly a commitment to go on crusade at some point, but what it effectively meant was that now he was a crusader, it was even more sinful for the barons to behave disobligingly towards him. Nevertheless, the situation descended into civil war. On the 5th of May, a group of barons renounced their allegiance to John, and on the 17th they took London. It was an awkward civil war, because the barons didn't really know what they wanted. During the anarchy, the options had been clear, Stephen or Matilda. But what was the alternative to John? A republic? Maybe it goes without saying, but I'm going to say it just in case, nobody was thinking of a republic. Really nobody. They probably hadn't even heard of the notion, and if they had, it would have been as a sinful ancient Roman concept, like lions eating Christians and anal sex. Countries had kings, and that was that. They were anointed and crowned, and as such endorsed by God. And John was the king. There was no doubt about that. We know it was an idea cooked up by some thugs in the Dark Ages, but they didn't. So the rebel barons' awkward demand was simply for John to be better. It was a civil war dedicated to getting one man to try harder and to be more reasonable. But John was 48. 48-year-old men seldom change. It was all a bit hopeless. a bloody liberty. Magna Carta was the Baron's attempt to address this problem, to come up with a framework to constrain this furious and infuriating idiot they were stuck with. It's got some big ideas in it, most notably clauses 39 and 40, which are still part of British law today. No free man shall be seized, imprisoned, dispossessed, outlawed, exiled, or ruined in any way, nor in any way proceeded against, except by the lawful judgment of his peers and the law of the land. And to no one will we sell, to no one will we deny or delay right or justice. To us, these are resonant and inspiring principles. Now they're getting the idea, we think. Democracy and freedom, here we come. That's true, in a way. At the time, though, it must have been very worrying. These self-evident truths that the authors of the American Declaration of Independence had in mind 5.5 centuries later were flying in the face of a bigger, more mystical and more reassuring principle, the one that was supposedly the basis for all medieval government and indeed the ordering of the entire universe, divine providence. The barons must have found it unsettling to have to write a document to rein in a king who was endorsed by God. They must have worried that they were doing something terrible, and they must have worried even more that the whole basis for existence they'd been brought up with was somehow failing. Libertarians must feel the same whenever they notice some arm of the state or set of regulatory laws help avert catastrophe. It reveals flaws in the big, comforting idea that's supposed to make everything okay. Clause 61 of Magna Carta provided for a council of 25 barons to ensure the king's adherence to the charter. It was empowered to confiscate his castles and lands if he strayed. This was a massive affront to the concept of kingship, the regal equivalent of what happened to Britney Spears, and John had no intention of abiding by it, whatever he said. This clause was omitted from the many reissuings of the Charter after John's death, the versions that eventually found their way onto the statute book, and played little subsequent part in history. Until recently, that is. In 2020, during the COVID pandemic, as part of the general internet-fueled stupidity of our time, some lockdown refuseniks took to citing Clause 61 of Magna Carta as a justification for ignoring lockdown rules. Their reasoning was that the clause made it legal to rebel against government that the people considered unjust. I'm quite fond of this sort of bullshit. A little learning can be a hilarious thing, and the same goes for a little Googling. Clause 61 of Magna Carta only gave 25 13th-century barons the right to rebel against unjust laws, not anyone at all, and it was only in the 1215 version of Magna Carta, which was repudiated by all signatories and the Pope within 3 months and never became law. So they were wrong twice. They were wrong about what the clause said, and they were wrong in thinking that it was ever law. Of course, if two wrongs genuinely make a right, they have a point. The barons and King John met to sign Magna Carta on the 10th of June 1215 at a place between Staines and Windsor called Runnymede. It's named after how nervous King John was about the occasion. No, it was already called Runnymede, from the Anglo-Saxon runi, meaning regular meeting, and mead, meaning meadow. So the runny bit has nothing to do with either diarrhoea or the proximity of a river, which is a pity. It was a place where important outdoor meetings had happened before and was one of the venues where King Alfred's Witan used to meet. What a felicitous precedent for a coming together of ruler and aristocracy. John must have been apprehensive, though, so he turned up wearing his grandmother Empress Matilda's imperial regalia to emphasise what a big shot he was. Whether wearing some 90-year-old clothes that were designed for a woman had that effect, we can't know. He signed the charter, but within weeks the Pope had condemned it as illegal and ordered John not to abide by it. In the short term, then, it was a failed peace treaty. But, like Henry I's coronation charter, it was influential and was reissued, without the anti-lockdown clause, several times in the following century, in 1297, ending up on the statute book, where shards of it still remain. Nevertheless, the barons' attempt to find a middle way between John and not John had failed, and they had to resort to the more old-fashioned civil war strategy of supporting a rival claimant to the throne. They plumped for Philip Augustus's son, Prince Louis. He was married to one of Henry II's granddaughters, so he did have a sketchy claim to the throne, plus he was a capable young man, and he wasn't John. The The rebel barons invited Louis over, and he landed in England in May 1216 and started conquering it. Pope Innocent III excommunicated him. By the end of the summer, Louis controlled the southeast of England, but John went on the counterattack and frenetically marched around the country relieving sieges. But his situation was still terrible. To add to his woes, the King of Scotland had also invaded, taken Carlisle, and then paid homage to Louis, thereby suggesting he was the rightful King of England, not John. It was around this time that John both contracted dysentery and supposedly lost the crown jewels in the Wash. This was the Wash as in the weird square tidal estuary at the top of East Anglia, not a laundering process necessitated by the sovereign's raging diarrhoea. We don't know exactly what was lost, but certainly a section of the king's baggage train misjudged the tides or the quicksand and was swallowed. This all adds to John's aura of haplessness as he raced around the place, his illness getting worse. He died at Newark Castle on the night of the 18th of October, 1216. He didn't make it to Christmas. Part 3. Here Comes the Rain Again. Chapter 21. King Henry III. Dying was by far the most astute and successful thing King John did in his entire reign. In general, when kings died, that was bad news for the royal dynasty and the security of the regime, but John had contrived to inoculate the realm against that affliction, so his sudden absence had no negative impact whatsoever. In fact, it was an unqualified boon. Had he been an iota less unpleasant or more competent, the barons might have been concerned by the replacement of an experienced 49-year-old man who'd been on the throne for 17 years and fought many campaigns in the British Isles and France with a 9-year-old boy. As it was, a crowned turd would have been preferable, so a biddable child under the guardianship of William Marshall, the elder statesman of the Plantagenet court, looked like a comparatively safe bet. Nevertheless, at the point when Henry III acceded to the throne, the Plantagenet situation was bleak. London and the southeast were under the control of Prince Louis, so Henry couldn't be crowned at Westminster, and there weren't any archbishops, nor even a crown, available. The bishops of Exeter, Worcester and Winchester, plus the papal legate, did the honours at Gloucester Abbey, using a coronet belonging to his mother, Queen Isabella. It was one of her few gestures of maternal support for young Henry. The following summer she went back to Angoulême in France, where she had come from, and where she remained for the rest of her life, having children with her second husband, Hugh X of Lusignan. Henry is a pitiable figure, and the aged William Marshall an inspiring, likeable, avuncular champion. "If all the world deserted the young boy except me," he apparently said, "do you know what I would do? I would carry him on my shoulders and walk with him thus and never let him down from island to island, from land to land." The image of an old man carrying a child to safety on his shoulders cuts through all the dynastic and regal bullshit. It's simple and human. It bespeaks love. We can't know what their feelings really were. There are so many centuries between us and them, and their world was, by our standards, weird. But they still ate and drank and lived and died and hoped and lusted and feared and felt lonely. William Marshall was a warrior and a politician, hugely rich and hugely successful. He'd been a Plantagenet loyalist his whole life, had been in and out of favour with John, who hadn't, but had shown consistent support of the principle of Angevin kingship. Earlier in his life, he'd been on crusade and served both Henry II and Henry the Young King, so it was apt that he ended his career serving Henry the Even Younger King. He was about 70 by the time Henry III became king, which was pretty old even to be alive in those days, so it seems likely that he was fond of the kid. As a supporter of John, he knew what a disaster his son had been born into, and must have looked on this child, wearing a woman's fascinator and carrying a man's sword amid medieval military turmoil, with a grandfather's fondness. Similarly, the fatherless child, suddenly told that God had appointed him in charge of everything, must have loved the indomitable old man who turned up and cared. Their love conquered all. Or England, anyway. As I've said, the momentum was going Henry III's way, however helpless he seemed, because the prospect of Prince Louis, son of an ambitious and aggressive King of France, becoming King of England, only looked attractive as an alternative to John. With John's replacement by an innocent child, all reasons for supporting the Frenchman evaporated. At the Battle of Lincoln in 1217, 76 years after another Battle of Lincoln, which had nearly handed the throne to Henry III's great-grandmother Matilda, William Marshall's army decisively defeated the rebel barons and supporters of Prince Louis. For Louis, the jig was up, and he headed home. By the Treaty of Lambeth later that year, he renounced his claim to the English throne and received 10,000 marks. The rebel barons were given an amnesty. Marshall, as regent of England and protector of the king, had done his young sovereign proud. Throne alone. William Marshall died in 1219, but Henry III's minority was far from over. In some ways, it continued for his whole reign. He never quite stopped being a child. But then why should he? He hadn't asked to be king. This is something many of us feel about the current royal family. They're trapped. They didn't ask for this. Theirs is a thankless role, and if they do get thanks, they're stressed and obsequious ones from anxious people holding flowers and reeking of shower gel. Few of us would swap places with them for all their wealth and fame. Many people don't want fame at all, but even those who do want it wouldn't want the shit sort the royals have got, a fame you're landed with and can't take any credit for. They've earned it even less than reality TV stars. Or rather, even less than other reality TV stars. We feel this absence of monarch envy all the more keenly because we're lucky enough to live in a time and place where the basics of a pleasant life – food, shelter, entertainment, freedom – are available to millions. The royals' riches and luxury count for much less than in more squalid eras. For most of history, the king, however overworked and unhappy, whatever the agonising RSI from endless crown-wearing he endured, at least knew where the next meal was coming from, which put him in the most fortunate section of society. The potential undesirability of being king hasn't been an issue in this book so far. Almost all the kings seemed to want to be king. Possible exceptions: Ethelred the Unready came to the throne as a child, and had a very unenjoyable reign, and Edward the Confessor was far too holy to enjoy anything. But in general, the preceding kings wanted to be king. They were into it and ambitious for it, however good or bad they were at it. Since the conquest, they also all got a decent amount of training for the job. William the Conqueror schooled his sons in the martial and political arts of the 11th century, and even the worst of them, Robert Curthose, was relatively professional. William II, Henry I, Stephen, Matilda, Henry II, Richard I and John were all keen on the job and grew up with major regal role models, close relatives who were actually rulers. The only ruler little Henry III knew was himself. His minority was a success. The kingdom was stabilised in his name, the rebellion ended, the French expelled. And that was his training in kingship. A period where everyone scraped and bowed to him, but grown-ups, adult men, replacement fathers made all the real decisions. It reminds me of the skewed life experiences of those child actors who make it big, like poor old Macaulay Culkin. Not that he's likely to be poor, and ridiculously, he's still not old. Weird childhoods, even if they're ostensibly successful, can screw you for life. So when Henry III tentatively embarked on his personal rule, it soon panned out as a dispiriting mixture of the weak and the delusional. He was often dominated by a chief adviser, whom he would follow to the point of alienating other major barons, and he showed divisive favouritism in terms of money, lands and offices to various groups of his relatives. Initially the Savoyard relations of his wife, Queen Eleanor of Provence, and then his Lusignan half-brothers, sons of his mother, the Dowager Queen Isabella of Angoulême. These are classic ways not to be a successful king, later honed by Edward II with disastrous consequences. Henry III hadn't quite perfected this brand of shitness, which is why, unlike Edward II, he didn't die in prison. On top of these failings, Henry had big dreams and schemes, but lacked the focus, resources, or talent to carry them through, except when it came to expensive architectural plans. He spent a lot of money on Westminster Abbey, the Tower of London, and Windsor Castle, striking a grand, regal, yet pious style. Beneath that style, there was no substance. He was very keen to reconquer the Angevin Empire, but the baronage was even less receptive to this agenda than during his father's reign. His three feeble, underfunded expeditions in 1230, 1242 and 1253 all failed and weakened him at home. More than ever, the English aristocracy viewed the monarch's attempts to defend or extend his French possessions as a private matter. It was not something they wanted to get involved with or help pay for. In 1254, he tried to make one of his sons, Edmund, King of Sicily. If you're struggling to get a sense of how realistic an aim this was, just work out how realistic it would be to make yourself King of Sicily and multiply that by 1.6. Not very realistic, then. This was an attempt by Henry to support the Pope, on whom, as one of those extremely pious kings, he was dead keen. For all sorts of no doubt holy reasons, the papacy wanted to stop the Sicilian throne remaining in the hands of the Hohenstaufen family, which was the dynasty that dominated the Holy Roman Empire before the Habsburgs got going. King Henry III of England gleefully got involved, offering troops and 135,000 marks he didn't have to help the papal cause in exchange for Edmund being declared the next king of that very distant island. Henry had no way of delivering on this promise, and yet, if he didn't, the Pope was threatening to excommunicate him, something which, as one of those extremely pious kings, he would find unbelievably upsetting. It was a terrible deal. SDMV. If you are wondering when Parliament was going to get invented, it's now. Thanks to the Magna Carta crisis, the concept of reining the king in, of expecting a certain amount of consultation on issues of major national fundraising and expenditure, had already been explored. The next king's long minority only intensified the magnate's expectation of being kept in the loop. Back in 1225, during that minority, a relatively successful campaign to shore up Gascony, the English king's remaining section of Aquitaine, had been financed off the back of the reissuing of Magna Carta. The deal that was being done between the crown and the powerful people of the realm was clear. It was money in exchange for consultation, rights, and limitations on royal prerogatives. About 5.5 centuries later, George III, the then King of England and Ireland, and by that time Scotland too, lost most of his North American possessions to a rebellion based on the idea of no taxation without representation. That whole principle originated in the era we're talking about now, when cash-strapped medieval kings, with territorial ambitions beyond their means, realised that they'd have to consult their prominent subjects and give guarantees of reasonable government if they wanted those lords to contribute to royal schemes. In 1236, the word Parliament was first used to refer to one such consultation session. By the time of the king's Sicilian fantasy, these parliaments are the established form of interaction between impecunious monarch and angsty aristos. At this point, the king would only summon his ministers and council, plus the leading magnates and churchmen, the archbishops, bishops, and heads of major monastic houses. It only amounted to a few dozen men. In 1258, as the ruinous nature of Henry's delusional geopolitical scheming became apparent, and as the barons despaired at the favouritism Henry continued to show to the unruly and contemptuous Lusignan, Parliament resolved to take on the king. The key mover and shaker in all this was a man called Simon de Montfort, who was Earl of Leicester and after whom de Montfort University in Leicester is named. He himself was named after his father, Simon de Montfort, who was named after his father, Simon de Montfort, who was named after his father, Simon de Montfort, who was named, you get the idea. The main one is the fifth Simon de Montfort of six. He named his son Simon de Montfort, but that one then died without issue, which I can't help thinking was for the best. Otherwise, there'd still be one now. The reason SDM the Fifth has a university named after him is that he founded Parliament, which is a jolly good thing to have done, leading as it did to democracy, freedom and the British Empire. That's what the Victorians reckoned anyway. Obviously, it's not entirely true, which in retrospect the Victorians might be relieved to hear, because one thing that is undeniable about SDM is that he was French. He'd only arrived in England in 1230. I don't think they would have been too keen on that. The whole British parliamentary tradition being kicked off by a Frenchman might have made their recent gargantuan struggle against Napoleon feel like a lot of wasted